Ngā kārangarangatanga maha o ngā hauwefa, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. I raro i te parirau o te tiriti o Waitangi, e mihi mai oha ki a koutou kua tai mai i tēnei pō. It's my privilege to welcome you as the kaihautu and acting chief executive to this forum here at Te Papa Tongarewa. Consistent with our mission, one of our purposes is to be a forum for the nation. And at this time of the year where we reflect on changes and shifts in what is happening within New Zealand, it's been a great opportunity for us to continue to hold a series of discussions related to kaupapa of the Treaty of Waitangi. This evening we are privileged to partner with the Law Centre, the Public Law Group of the Victoria University of Wellington, and it's with them that we're able to bring this series of discussions for your consideration, for your thought, and for questions later on in the evening. It's now my privilege to introduce Dr. Claudia Orange, who along with Dean Knight, a senior lecturer of the Law School, at Victoria University, who will be chairing our series for this evening. So without further ado, if I can introduce Dr. Claudia Orange, who is currently the Director of Collections and Research here at Te Papa Tongarewa. Kia koe, Claudia, no mai, haere mai.
Thank you, Michelle Hippolyte, and now kia ora tātou katoa, and welcome to the first of the 2010 Treaty Debate Series in Soundings Theatre, Te Papa Wellington. The series is organised by Te Papa in association with Victoria University's New Zealand Centre for Public Law. My name is Claudia Orange, Director of Collections and Research at Te Papa, and I'm chairing this session with Dean Knight, Associate Director of the New Zealand Centre for Public Law. Dean is not only a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law, he is one of the associate directors of the Centre for Public Law, and his scholarly work is very central to some of the things we're going to talk about tonight. His scholarly interests are in public law, particularly administrative law, judicial review, and local democracy. He's written and edited a number of articles, chapters, and books on New Zealand's system of constitutional and administrative law. And I'm particularly interested to see that he also has a blog on legal and policy issues called Laws 179, Elephants and the Law. The subject for this year's series is evolution and not revolution. And I might explain that I selected this title when reflecting recently on how New Zealand has changed over the 35 years since the establishment of the Waitangi Tribunal in 1975. And unlike many other countries, we have taken an evolutionary path in race relations and not a revolutionary one. And yet, in the last 40 years, we've witnessed what I'd call revolutionary changes for our country and in our relationships between Māori and the state. Well, today, Professor Paul Spoonley is the first speaker, and the title of his presentation is Making New Zealand. His topic covers the years of activity in Māori and related matters that has led to our country into an evolutionary pattern of change rather than the revolutionary one. Well, there have been key players in those years of change, and one is certainly Orangi Nui Walker, who is here with us and who will comment later on Paul's lecture. Paul, of course, is going to cover much of Rangi's life, and for those of you who are not so familiar about that, you will perceive what a significant person he has been. But I'd like to introduce him a little bit more fully later. After the lecture and comments and questions, of course, we will be asking for questions and comments from you, the audience. But first, I have much pleasure in introducing Professor Spoonley. Paul holds a personal chair in sociology at Massey University, Auckland. He began his academic research in the mid-1970s on the local reactions to the arrival of Pacific migrants. Since then, he has researched and written on Pākehā identity, Māori-Pākehā relations, right-wing extremism and anti-Semitism. Currently, he heads a major research project on the present settlement of immigrants in New Zealand. Professor Paul Spoonley.
Ngā mihi kia koutou, ka tika, kia mihi atu kia ranganui, tō iwi whakatuhia e rangatira tēnā koe, tēnā koutou katoa. I want to identify and discuss the events and the people that have contributed to what I believe can be justifiably referred to as a paradigm shift that occurred in the 1970s and 1980s in New Zealand. An imperial and colonial frame of reference was replaced by one that recognised to a much greater degree the Treaty of Waitangi and the rights of tangata whenua in the context of a liberal democratic state. How we now currently operate in our public spaces and renegotiated sense of what it means to be a New Zealander is dramatically different from that that occurred previously. The shift is required that our key institutions, Parliament, the justice and education systems, for instance, operate in ways that are now very different, and often radically so, and without precedent to guide those responsible. It thrusts new people and new organisations into leadership roles, and one of those who played a key role, Rangnu Walker, is with us tonight, and I'll return to his contribution shortly. The events of the mid-20th century set the scene for what was to follow. With some notable exceptions, the state had pursued what I would define as ethnocide, of seeking to achieve the cultural assimilation, the total cultural assimilation of Māori until the 1970s and the 1980s. But if cultural assimilation was the goal, the reality was that Māori were marginalised economically and largely confined to very poor rural areas in New Zealand. By the 1930s, half of all Pākehā lived in urban communities in this country and a third lived in four main cities. I should add that the threshold of what constituted an urban community was modest, 8,000 people. What effectively changed the socio-economic and spatial separation between Māori and Pākehā was the Second World War. The war has been labelled the People's War because it mobilised large numbers and that this involvement took place with popular support. It certainly mobilised Māori, and it was inevitable that having taken part in such a nationally and globally important event, that returning to remote rural communities might not be attractive. The state also played its role with the 1945 Economic, Social and Economic Advancement Act and incentives to encourage greater Māori participation in the growing urban sector. The result was the relocation of Māori to urban and Pākehā, New Zealand. In 1945, at least 75% of Māori were located in rural areas, and some estimates put that figure at 85%. By the mid-1970s, the figure had flipped completely, with 75% now urban dwellers and 20% of them in Auckland. The size, rapidity and impact of this migration was very significant for what was to follow. But if this meant Māori and Pākehā were in much closer proximity, it did not mean necessarily that Māori were any more engaged in many aspects of our contemporary New Zealand society. In the 1950s, less than 5% of Māori left school having obtained school certificate. And of the 3,000 students at the University of Auckland, fewer than 20 were Māori. But this migration did two things. It did eventually give more Māori an opportunity to access the institutions of urban New Zealand, and this did eventually provide a leadership for what was to follow. But it also highlighted what had been lost through the process of colonisation and ethnocide. The contrast was increasingly there for all to see between the affluence of many Pākehā and the position of Māori, between the lack of recognition of Māori culture and language and the emphasis given to European-derived values and institutions. It was perhaps inevitable that that situation would be challenged and would no longer be tolerated. And the trigger points were to come in the mid-1960s when the Pritchard-Wakeford Report on Māori Land Titles and the 1967 Māori Affairs Amendment Act occurred. Enter stage left, new players in the form of Māori protest groups. The 1970 Young Māori Leaders Conference produced Ngā Tamatoa, They represented a young, urban-born and raised generation who were too happy to contest colonialism in new ways. It's also, I think, important to acknowledge what was happening internationally. It could be argued that in 1945, the British Empire was at its peak. A small island off continental Europe had withstood the ambitions of European fascism by marshalling its extensive global resources to fight, along with the help of allies such as the USA. It was Britain's finest hour. In that euphoria, the British government passed the 1945 Colonial Development and Welfare Act, which signalled their willingness to take economic responsibility for all of its colonial subjects and to provide for self-government. But it soon became apparent that the first commitment could not be met, while the second meant the decline of the empire and its replacement with the Commonwealth. Britain was no longer the superpower that we knew, and it turned its attention to becoming part of Europe despite de Gaulle's antagonism. The cultural and economic umbilical cord that had tied New Zealand to Britain for most of its colonial history was now under threat. The new superpower was, of course, the USA, and it was to provide one very interesting dimension and influential exemplar of protest politics. The black civil rights movement gained in momentum through the 1950s and 1960s, and it was to supply Māori activists with a new rhetoric as well as some new strategies. Interestingly, that rhetoric did not necessarily come from those black American activists, but it came from the French Caribbean in the form of writers and activists such as Aimé Césaire and France Fanon. Here were arguments about the importance of black activism in the process, what was increasingly a global process, of decolonisation. After all, the white working class and their organisations were not going to be interested in helping blacks. It was also a time of rebellion of the young. As the English commentator Eric Hobsbawm notes, the golden age of widespread influence was coming to an end, and the student uprisings in Paris in May 1968 soon had global equivalents from communist Europe to the USA and Mexico, and of course New Zealand. Hobsbawm goes on to observe that these students stood, quote, at an awkward angle to the rest of society. They had no established place. Well, that was certainly true of Māori protest politics. One of the first times that many of us began to realise that this was the case came with the land march from Te Hapua to Parliament in 1975. The organising group, Te Matakete o Aotearoa, involved both conservative and radical elements in what was a fragile coalition, a coalition that only lasted until Parliament, when agreement about aims and strategies collapsed. For much of the next decade, the politics of younger Māori recast the issues and possibilities of identity rights in New Zealand. For me, one of the most powerful statements came in the form of the Donna Awatere essays, which appeared in Broadsheet, and then her 1985 book, Māori Sovereignty. The possibility that a nation-state could be subdivided and that some of the state's sovereignty might be allocated to Māori was and remains a very powerful claim. She not only challenged Pākehā to rethink their commitment to colonial institution values, she also directed her criticism at Māori institutions and leadership. The period from the land march in 1975 to the appearance of the Māori Sovereignty Book in 1984 was the period of Māori mobilisation. It started with a relatively small group of younger committed activists and ended with the support of major Māori leaders and organisations. A new phase of recognition and policy was to emerge as the decade of the 1980s continued, but at this point I think it's timely to recognise a key player in these politics, Professor Ranganui Walker. In writing Ranganui's biography, which was recently published as Matatua, I realised how transforming these decades had been for individuals such as Ranganui, as much as they had been for our institutions. At the Auckland Readers and Writers Festival last year, I described Ranganui as an accidental activist. As he himself acknowledges, he was an unlikely player, much less a leader in the identity politics of the 1970s and 1980s. He was a product of a conservative religious and political background. He was schooled in a Catholic education system, and his family were national supporters. The latter's hardly unique. If we look back at those older Māori who played a leadership role in the 1970s, people such as Matt Tahau, John Rangihau, Graham Latimer, James Henare and Fina Cooper all were involved in the National Party and nearly all held senior positions in it. But Ranganui was to tread a different path, and I think two things are particularly influential. The first was that he was highly qualified in an educational sense. Very few Māori were PhD qualified, certainly in 1970 when he finished his degree. It gave him skills and a status. But secondly, he was recruited by his uncle, Matt Te Hau, to help run the Auckland District Māori Council. The catchment for this particular Māori council included both traditional iwi and hapu groupings, but also, of course, the growing migrant urban Māori. From the 1970 Young Māori Leaders Conference and the establishment of Ngā Tamatoa, and Ranganui was there, Ranganui was exposed to these politics of the Māori Renaissance. His destiny was set in part by his own educational achievements, but also by his growing involvement in these urban politics. Ranganui, of course, in turn became a key contributor to the developments that were to take place over the next decades. The Auckland District Māori Council, under his leadership, became an important voice on the issues as they emerged both within and in Auckland and a national context. At times, the council looked and sounded quite different to every other Māori council, including the National Māori Council. Sporting contacts with South Africa was one issue where Ranganui and the Auckland District Māori Council were to provide a moral compass. His column in The Listener and then his book Ka Whawhai Tonu Matau were to offer insights into a colonial history and Māori concerns to a New Zealand that had seldom encountered such direct criticism of our major institutions and of our leaders. Our understanding of our history was being revised, and as the historian Michael Belgrave notes, Ranganui helped develop, quote, a grand indigenous narrative that not only told a very different story of cultural survival of Māori, but indicated what was required to restore justice as he and others saw it. Of course, this task was not left to Ranganui alone, and Ka Whawhai Tonu Matau was preceded by a number of Pākehā historians and others who helped construct a very different history of colonialism. Honourable mention ought to be made of Dick Scott, Claudia Orange, Jock Phillips, Jamie Bellich, and Anne Salmond. But Ka Whawhai Tonu Matau, which was published in 1990, was the most important and influential colonial history by a Māori author. What is interesting is that his criticisms were couched in a language which was familiar to the middle classes who provided the management and leadership of our core institutions. His was an original and powerful voice in critiquing the state, although, of course, not the only voice. It was a voice that took the arguments of an international politics of liberation, the Marxism of Gramsci and the notion of hegemony, the critiques of colonialism offered by Fanon and Césaire, the liberation theory and the possibilities of a transformative education of Freire and Illich, and put them into a New Zealand vernacular. Here was a set of intellectual ideas applied to the particular circumstances of this country. It was a contemporary sensibility to what he said, a recasting of arguments to appeal to New Zealanders, Māori and Pākehā alike, and the case for justice to be restored to Māori. Those who claimed that he harked back to an archaic and irrelevant past could not have been more wrong. He was, as were most of the younger radical Māori, a moderniser. He was influenced by critical and Marxist traditions, but not in a theoretical or dogmatic way. The ultimate benchmark was that these ideas needed to work in a New Zealand setting, and they needed to speak to New Zealanders, including those New Zealanders who had no interest in Marxism. What is intriguing is that we start with a son of the empire, of Catholicism, of a traditional tikanga, who became a critic of all these dimensions of a colonial New Zealand. If you doubt the claims about his willingness to critique his own, including the relevance of traditional Māori values to the position faced by contemporary Māori, then I suggest you read his book, Opotiki Mai Tāwhiti, on his own iwi, Whakatuhia. By 1984, a new agenda had been set and the ambitions of Māori clearly articulated. At its core was the need to recognise the Treaty of Waitangi and the commitments made by the signatories to each other. Of course, the understanding was that these failures, that any failures, had been largely those of the Crown. There ought to be some reallocation of resources so that while Māori might not gain exactly what they had lost, there would at least be some recognition of these losses as well as a resource base on which to fund Māori futures. The claims that the core institutions of New Zealand were institutionally racist invited a reconsideration of how they might more adequately recognise and respond to Māori communities. And the claims of Māori sovereignty, by now identified as Tino Rangatiratanga, raised questions about the devolution of resources and services so that Māori organisations and communities could control their own destiny, at least partially. It was a radical agenda, a revolutionary agenda, but underpinning it was something much more fundamental about the nation-state. For much of the 20th century, it was assumed that a state operated on behalf of a single nation, that the two, the nation and the state, were indivisible. The state represented all New Zealanders. It deserved their undivided loyalty, and in return, the state was neutral with respect to the ethnic identity of its citizens. The identity politics of Māori challenged all of these elements. The nation was made up, it was argued, of two key groups, and the operation of the state ought to recognise the particular circumstances and the rights of Māori, something which it had not done previously. In fact, the state was seen to operate in ways that directly disadvantaged Māori. The state was hardly neutral. According to Ranganui and others, the state preserved Pākehā interests, even if it continued to claim universality and neutrality. It was a radical rethinking of what the nation-state of New Zealand ought to be. It required a decoupling of the nation, now defined as Māori and Pākehā, or Māori and the Crown, and required the state to operate in new and different ways. A new understanding and a new social contract needed to be established. But of course, there was no compulsion for the state to acknowledge these new expectations. It was left to the good sense and the sensitivities of some key players, Māori, Pākehā and representatives of the state, to explore what this meant. It is important to acknowledge that there has been something of a history in policy documents that had documented some of the fundamental inequities faced by Māori. The book, The Māori People Today, edited by ILG Sutherland, which appeared in 1940, still provides a very interesting account of the ways in which Māori were marginalised in New Zealand, as does the 1960 Hun Report. And by the 1970s, there were Pākehā groups such as the Auckland Committee on Racism and Discrimination that were adding to the evidence. Was the state going to respond, and if so, how? Well, it did, of course, and the 1975 Treaty of Waitangi Act was a cautious but still very important first step. Norm Kirk's Waitangi Day speeches are worth revisiting in this regard. By the way, they're available in a publication called Towards Nationhood. On the 6th of February 1973, he said, and I quote, "The Treaty of Waitangi has stood for 133 years. The focus and dignity of that agreement should and will be recognised by Parliament in the form that signifies and symbolises the importance of that treaty to every New Zealander." And a year later, on the same occasion, he said, and I quote, "As Britain joins her destiny with Europe's, we must now draw upon the spiritual and cultural strength of the people who make our nation. I know we have not reached the end of the road. We have scarcely started the journey. The Māori people are in the midst of a great migration as significant and meaningful as the migration that brought them to the shores of New Zealand. As they move from country to town, as the lifestyle changes, as the old traditions of history and culture are drawn upon, so new methods, new traditions are in the making. All of us together are, in our own way, making New Zealand." They were prophetic words and indicate something of Norm Kirk's sympathy for what was emerging. But the action was to be curtailed as that sympathy was not shared by the subsequent national government led by Muldoon. It was left to the 1984 Labour government to take up the challenge, and the irony was that at the same time that policy and legislation provided for identity recognition and reparation, the effect of the Labour government's own economic reforms had a devastating effect on Māori. Constitutional policy recognition came at the expense of economic security for many Māori. The 1975 land march in the final months of the 1972 Labour government had made it clear that the government had not lived up to its promises concerning Māori. A decade later, the 1984 Labour government's period in office began with yet another march, the Hikoi te Waitangi. That was a very powerful reminder that there were unfulfilled expectations concerning the recognition of Māori for the incoming government. But the hikoi was also a powerful statement about who those expectations came from. The hikoi now involved the full range of Māori political opinion and organisations, notably, of course, Tainui. The new Labour government of 1984 were prepared to recognise treaty rights. A group of ministers, Geoffrey Palmer, Kōra Wetere and Russell Marshall, worked on the incorporation of the principles of the treaty into new legislation. The label principles was first referred to in the 1975 Treaty of Waitangi Act. In March 1986, a cabinet paper from Palmer and Wetere examined what recognition of the treaty meant for the government, and a June paper in the same year required that all legislation, and I quote, draw attention to any implications for recognition of the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, end quote, and that Māori should be consulted. Between 1985 and 1989, 15 statutes included references to the treaty, and the treaty clause in the State-Owned Enterprises Act proved to be particularly significant. Did the government and its senior public service managers know what they were doing? I tend to agree with Claudia Orange, who has argued that the far-reaching implications of the Cabinet Directive on the treaty were not at first apparent, nor was there a clear ministerial strategy. She goes on to say that a largely monocultural public service initially put the directive to one side, but the implications soon became apparent. The Waitangi Tribunal, the courts, and the actions of Māori organisations all tested what this legislative recognition of the treaty meant, with what can only be described as a number of interesting impacts on the government's market reforms. And the public service was not exempt. The 1986 Ministerial Advisory Committee report, Puao Te Atatū, commented on what they defined as the institutional racism of the Department of Social Welfare. A major government department was deemed to have failed in its core business of delivering appropriate services to Māori. Puao Te Atatū helped contribute to a new agenda, a bicultural agenda, for government departments, especially those which had a significant Māori client base. So in the years 1985 to 1989, we see the key elements of a new social contract between the state and Māori. Those elements included recognition, especially in legislation, of the Treaty of Waitangi, the policies of biculturalism in the public service, greater recognition of Māori language rights and tikanga Māori, limited self-government, primarily through the devolution of social and educational services to Māori organisations and communities, and the transfer of resources to Māori in recognition of their rights as tangata whenua and as reparation for the effects of colonialism. The subsequent Bolger government was ready to honour these elements of the social contract. Indeed, some of the most significant settlements were to come in the 1990s. The developments such as the arrival of MMP provided new possibilities in terms of political representation for Māori, although the full implications of these possibilities were, of course, not to be realised until 2004. The contract that was negotiated in the 1980s has endured remarkably well and largely intact. It has survived 7 general elections, 3 different prime ministers, and 2 significant economic downturns. It has not all been to the liking of people such as Ranganui. The breakup of the Department of Māori Affairs in the late 1980s to be replaced by Te Puna Kōkiri was disappointing, as the delivery of major social and economic programs were to be replaced by the provision of policy advice. The fiscal envelope of the early 1990s, which set a cap on Treaty of Waitangi claims, appeared also to limit Māori treaty rights. Ranganui was concerned that tino rangatiratanga was often too narrowly defined as the tino rangatiratanga of certain iwi, or that tino rangatiratanga had been a step too far for any government. And the new social contract has proved unable to deal with a significant issue: the ongoing socio-economic disadvantage of Māori individuals and households. There is little doubt that Māori organisations and many iwi have benefited from what has happened in the last 3 decades. The reports commissioned by Te Puna Kōkiri in 2003 and then again in 2007 on the Māori economy demonstrate how significant Māori ownership and production is to the New Zealand economy. It can be seen in sectors such as fisheries, farming, tourism and forestry. This Māori economy was calculated as being worth $9 billion in 2003, and that was a 40% increase over the value of the Māori economy only 7 years previously. But that corporate and collective wealth contrasts with the relative lack of Māori household wealth. Before the economic reforms of the 1980s, Māori income was 92% of the national median income. By 2007, it had slipped to 83%. And a fifth of all Māori lost their jobs between 1987 and 1989. Labour's policy of closing the gaps after 2000 seemed to be a recognition that something needed to be done. But Ranganui was to be disappointed, as he himself said at the time. And I quote Ranganui here, "When Helen set an objective for her government to close the gaps between Māori and Pākehā by the year 2015, it was the most visionary policy set by any politician in recent times. Unfortunately, the policy was dropped from the political agenda when it was criticised by the opposition as favouring Māori ahead of poor Pākehā. The gaps remain structurally entrenched because of the failure of political will to deal with an issue that is a shame to our nation and a blot on our humanity." The social contract has been challenged on other occasions. Two that are worth brief mention both occurred in 2004. The brash nationhood speech at Uriwa in 2004 argued for a return to a single nation of New Zealanders who were not differentiated by law, a return to one law for all. These sentiments had and continue to have an audience, but what was surprising was how limited that audience by 2004 was, and how disastrous that speech proved to be for Brash himself. Apart from media condemnation, the response from Māori was dismissive, including from inside the National Party. As Hekia Parata said at the time, "I am Māori, so to suggest that it is the amount of Māori blood coursing through my veins that determines the degree of cultural identity or my citizenship is nonsense. We are indeed all New Zealanders, just not the same New Zealanders." The other test to these newfound rights of Māori was provided by the foreshore and seabed debate and legislation. The, quote, "common heritage of all New Zealanders," unquote, was seen as a denial of Māori rights, and this was unacceptable. And one of the largest protests ever to be seen in Wellington made that very clear. Ranganui again leapt into the debate. With respect to the foreshore of his whakatohia iwi, he wrote, and I'm quoting Ranganui, "This remnant of coastline is sacred to me. It's mine, and I will not concede it to you who represent the Crown. I reserve the right to apply to the Māori Land Court for title bequeathed to me by my ancestors. I will not sell 1 millimetre of my coastline, and I will continue to share it, as I've always done, with those who love Kai Moana, as I do. You ask who I am? I am Te Whakatohia Ki o Potiki." And as Māori representation on the Super City has recently highlighted, perhaps it is inevitable that the treaty and the rights of Māori will continue to be challenged. But as I indicated at the outset, what is surprising is the extent to which there is agreement that Māori do have rights and the willingness of governments since the 1980s, with some exceptions, to agree to these rights, or at least some of them. Are there unresolved issues? Absolutely. For me, some of the key ones include the following. The first is concerns tangata whenua rights. If tangata whenua rights are to be defined as primarily those of the iwi who signed the treaty, what happens to non-iwi Māori, those who are not attached or do not identify with a particular iwi? Do they have the same rights? Do they have different rights? Do they have rights? The next is the issue I have already highlighted. The events of the past decade have certainly improved the wealth and economic activity of many Māori, iwi and organisations, but this does not always extend to Māori households or individuals. Was closing the gap such a bad policy? And what would do most to address Māori poverty? This, I believe, remains a key and very important policy challenge. And finally, how do the very high levels of immigration post the 1987 policy changes? We have the highest levels of immigration per capita in the OECD and have had since 2000. Impact on the recognition of Māori rights. Do we need to develop a form of multiculturalism which supplements biculturalism rather than competes with it? What was negotiated in the 1970s and 1980s has sent us on a very different path. Our understanding of who we are has been revised, not the least in the extent to which the identity rights of tangata whenua are now recognised as part of the process of building this nation that is Aotearoa New Zealand. We have revised our understanding of what happened in a colonial past and sought to rectify some of the negative and unjust effects through a treaty settlement process. And we have developed a new vocabulary and new ways of operating in our core institutions, as well as developing some completely new institutions and a sense of what is possible. I would suggest that while the journey is far from complete, that what we have developed is a form of liberal nationalism, one that is prepared to recognise the rights of Māori. These rights at times might be curtailed and they might be subject to constant negotiation, but the alternative of politically driven illiberal nationalism has found very little support in recent years. We could argue that the recognition might not go far enough and that some New Zealanders are still far from happy with what has emerged. But it is a tribute to those who played a key role, people such as Ranganui Walker, that they were prepared to negotiate a new social contract in good faith, a matter of using the ballot rather than bullets, to achieve much more than many of us might have thought possible 3 decades ago. It has been, to say the least, an interesting journey, and I wonder where it will go from here. Whakatau mai kukiri tātou, kia ora tātou, katoa.
Thank you, Professor Spoonley, speaking in the first session of the Treaty Debates series at Te Papa in Wellington on the subject of the Treaty of Waitangi, Evolution and Not Revolution. I'd like to invite shortly Emeritus Professor Ranganui Walker to join in and to comment, but first I'd just like very briefly to capture again some of the key points of his biography. Paul mentioned he is of the Whakatauhia iwi, an academic, an author, biographer, historian, commentator, activist and iwi consultant. He's been professor and head of Māori studies at the University of Auckland and was appointed to the Waitangi Tribunal in 2003. For many years, many of us knew him best possibly by his regular column in The Listener, which educated the public on Māori issues and filmed the basis of one of his first books that Paul referred to, Ka Whawhai Tonu Mātou. But his many publications are legion, and they include the biography of that famous Māori leader, Sir Aparana Nata, and more recently also a biography of Paki Harrison of Ngāti Porou, one of New Zealand's great master carvers. Rangi also, of course, and most importantly, received the honour of Distinguished Companion of the New Zealand Order of Merit in 2009. It was very much an important marker of how significant he has been. Now, Rangi Nui, surprisingly, is not going to give a formal speech, but he is ready for questions, and he has never been one to hold back. Dean, on my right, I'm going to ask you to lead off and comment on perhaps on Paul's lecture, but also to challenge Rangi Nui to respond. Dean, over to you.
Kia ora mō tēnā. And I think we've been treated to a historical account of the evolution of modern-day New Zealand through the latter part of the last century, and that very much that struggle to ensure society recognises and embraces the rights, the interests and aspirations of Māori, of iwi and hapū. And we've heard particular reference to a number of the key players, including one of our commentators tonight, Dr. Ranganui Walker, who we'll shortly be hearing from, and their contribution to that change. When we reflect on the comments from Professor Spoonley, I think we see that much of the account has been framed as uncharted incremental change led by accidental activists through fragile coalitions. Kiwis, both Māori and Pākehā, muddling through of evolution, not revolution. All in all, though, a successful if incomplete evolution. I'd be interested in the extent to which that characterisation is shared by Ranganui Walker. But one thing we may ask ourselves is to what extent was it still necessary to have those revolutionary moments, or at least the revolutionary spirit within that process of evolution. How important was it to the mobilisation of the movement of Māoridom to frame the campaign as a battle against the imperial establishment, a liberation movement against an oppressive Pākehā state, spurred into action by instances of ill-treatment or abuse, the land marches of Ōrewa, the foreshore and seabed, and the like. And I think, and I pose this question not merely as a point of historical reflection, because I think it perhaps speaks more to the future. And if we accept Professor Spoonley's evaluation that we have entered the new decade with a spirit of enlightenment, increased involvement of Māori in government and governance, and a new social contract, what does that different dynamic mean for mobilisation of Māoridom and allied Pākehā to address those unresolved issues that he speaks of? With Māori and the indigenously branded Māori Party sitting in key positions within the institutions of government, what does it mean today for the activation of that revolutionary spirit? Is Māoridom now consigned to catalysing evolution from within? Or is there still a place for the revolutionary attitude, the activism of old? And if so, who will be tomorrow's accidental activists? Where will they come from, especially if many of the leaders have refocused their energy to making change from within government? Does the strategy for evolution need itself to evolve? Now, with those brief reflections and questions, I pose those questions to our speakers tonight, Professor Walker and Spoonley.
Well, there's a challenge for you boys. Off you go. Rangi Nui.
Kia ora, everybody. Thank you for turning out to hear us tonight. As Paul has alluded, I come from a very conservative background, but initially I grew up in an isolated valley. It's a long way from the Rahui Valley to Auckland, I can tell you. It was a traditional whānau hapū situation where my tribe was crammed into a reservation after the confiscation of the major portion of our land. It was an idyllic existence. No one hungered, no one suffered, children were not beaten. There was love all around me from uncles and aunts and cousins and older siblings. It was an idyllic, warm and comforting world. But it was an unreal world because it was unsustainable. And then in time, I came to the real world outside where it was much more competitive. And I knew that that was the world that I had to learn to live in and survive. And the way to get there was through education and working hard. I was always near the top of the class. And at high school, I set goals for myself to get degrees, a bachelor's. I put them, wrote them up on the blackboard. A Bachelor of Arts, a Master of Arts, and a PhD. And once I'd achieved the PhD, that was when I was called back into the Māori world to help support the people in their struggle against the state that had oppressed them. Now, I personally never felt oppressed because my parents were successful farmers. But I couldn't help but sympathise with those who felt that oppression. And in due course, they appeared at some of the meetings that I chaired on behalf of the Auckland District Māori Council. They were angry. They were talking revolutionary talk, which they derived from the black activists of America, Malcolm X, Eldridge Cleaver. They were talking about bathing the streets in blood, Māori Liberation Front. Now, I was taken aback by that rhetoric. I'd never heard of it. And I feared for the future of my nation if we were going to follow the riots of Watts in America and other places, Detroit. And so I took it upon myself as an educated person working within the university to write about these things in the New Zealand Listener. Is it to be revolution or evolution? And this is what lies ahead of us. Either we will do it peacefully or you will reap the whirlwind. Fortunately, people realise the need to transform our state, and that's what has happened. And Paul has given you a very, very good and clear summary of those events from the 1970s through to the present day. So I didn't come here to talk to you really because I've been in retirement for 13 years. I do other things in my life. I don't give public lectures. I don't talk at conferences. However, I am willing to answer any questions that you would like to raise. Thank you.
Thanks, Rangi. Paul, have you like to add any comments here?
No, not at all. I think we should turn to the audience.
I'd like to just pose a question to Rangi, and he's probably given me a one-line answer too. In many ways, when I am an Aucklander, and when Rangi was very articulate in the Auckland Māori Council, I couldn't help thinking at that time that maybe he was the right person in the right place at the right time. I mean, he was close to radio, he was close to the media, and so not only was he articulate in the Listener in a very more formal sense, he could very quickly respond to radio. So, Rangi, you must have realised too, surely, that you could use the media in such a way that you could score points in an articulate and logical way that would attune to the ear of the largely monocultural population? That's a question.
Absolutely, but sometimes my ability in communicating with the media got me into trouble. Like, for instance, I was on the fly at the time, very busy in the department in the university that I worked in, and on the run, one of the secretaries called me, "Hey, a reporter wants you on the line." So I grabbed the phone, and it was about Māori involvement in crime, Māori theft, and so on. And I was really in a hurry, and I was quite dismissive of the question. I said, "Look, I just regard crime or theft as redistribution of wealth." Whereupon this radio jock, a real smart ass he was, he called on his listeners to go around to Rangi Walker's place and help themselves.
Dean, have you got an answer that's about to come out?
An answer?
Or a question?
I can pose a question. I wonder if we can interrogate the borrowing of some of the strategies from the civil rights movements from abroad, and both of our speakers tonight have alluded to that. But I guess there's two questions we may ask about how successful that was within the uniquely New Zealand environment. And we might look at that in two ways, or ask ourselves about that in two ways. First, to what extent is the New Zealand community sympathetic to framing claims for change in the language of rights? Does that resonate with New Zealand, or did we need to seek different ways to base claims for change in fairness and decency rather than the language of rights? And secondly, to what extent was our process of activism and change in New Zealand more successful due to the smallness of our community and the fact that our closeness as brothers and sisters together, and were we more successful in our movements of change because of the fact that we stood side by side together or lived side by side together?
I'll answer both briefly, and I'm sure Ranganui will add to those. I think the rights that were imported were redefined locally and given, as I suggested, a New Zealand vernacular. So the rights became rights that were particular to this country. And what's interesting is somebody who looks internationally, I find that very often the New Zealand experiences around rights discussions and debates don't migrate internationally. Our rights debates are very particular to New Zealand. In terms of your second question, I think size is absolutely important. And I think we ought to acknowledge the goodwill and the attitude of the participants, the key participants, but size has always been to our benefit. And you can see that not simply in what we're talking about tonight in terms of treaty rights. We can see that in a range of other areas of being able to manage quite revolutionary change, in Claudia's words, in a way that doesn't have the whirlwind that Ranganui referred to.
For those of us who were born in our traditional tribal rural communities, we knew who we were. We knew our whakapapa, we knew our ancestors, we knew our waka. But the first generation city-born didn't have that knowledge. They felt lost, alienated, deprived of their language. And these were the angry young activists who appeared before their elders and complained about the Pākehā system oppressing them. So that pushed us into the position of having to negotiate, particularly with the education system, the power brokers within the education department, to ensure that Māori language, Māori culture were incorporated into our pedagogy. And of course, over the last 25, 30 years, that has happened. And our nation is all the better for it.
Thanks, Rangi. You're listening, of course, to the first session in the Treaty Debates series in Soundings Theatre Te Papa on the subject of the treaty. And the series has been organised as a way of providing you, the public, with information on treaty-related issues and to give you an opportunity to consider and discuss those issues. And we are now going to invite questions and comments from the floor. And Dean Knight will have just a few words of caution again about this part of the evening. Dean.
Thank you, Claudia. You'll see there are microphones to the front of each side of the auditorium that are available for any of you, the audience, to speak. If you'd like to do so, please make your way down to the microphone and hopefully, if necessary, queue up in an orderly fashion behind the microphones. When you speak, please give your name. And remember, the microphone is sensitive. You need to speak directly into it, but not too closely, please. And finally, a reminder again to please make your questions brief, no long statements, please.
Kia ora koutou. My name is Holly Walker. I'm no relation, I believe. I was really interested in what Professor Spoonley said and quoted Professor Walker about the Closing the Gaps policy, as I have recently completed a master's thesis about the decline of that policy. And I've been thinking a lot about what happened with that policy and also about inequality in New Zealand in general. There's some really interesting research which has recently come out of the UK in a book called The Spirit Level, which shows how harmful persistent inequality is, not only for those who are the poorest, but actually for entire societies. And it also shows how New Zealand is one of the most unequal societies in the world in terms of socioeconomic measures. And of course, a really big part of that is persistent disparities between Māori and non-Māori. And given what happened to Closing the Gaps and the Orewa speech that Don Brash delivered in 2004, and perhaps even recent hints at a similar feeling from the Leader of the Opposition, I wonder what you think are the chances of a policy that's dedicated at closing those gaps ever being successful in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. Rangi.
Kia ora, thank you for that. When Māori activism manifested itself in the 1970s, and I had to talk about it publicly, people would get all upset about it, and they would ask for a ready answer. And my simple answer was, all they want is justice and equality. Now, that's a simple goal, surely, to achieve. And the only way to achieve that equality is through the education system. Certainly there is some redistribution of wealth going on now through the treaty settlement process, and there are some wealthy iwi emerging which have multi-million dollar enterprises. But the trickle-down theory doesn't always work with the general community, let alone with the Māori community. So there's still quite a large group of people who are part of the gaps in health, in education and social status. And the only way to close that gap is to address it through education.
Hello, James Cohn. I wonder if either of you would care to comment on the ways in which the arrangements for covering the World Cup demonstrate the closeness of New Zealanders or our mutual goodwill. Thank you.
The World Cup.
I'm not an expert on the World Cup and its coverage. What struck me at the time, though, was that probably our most publicly spirited media outlet was denied the opportunity to cover a major event in New Zealand. And I'm disappointed at that, and I'm disappointed at what was subsequently negotiated. I think they would have done a fantastic job.
Yeah, my response to that question, it shows how immature we still are as a nation. That the minister in charge of the World Cup renegotiated the deal, and it was a deal between TVNZ and TV3, and it looked like two Pākehā channels making common cause against the Māori channel, which espouses a public broadcasting role in New Zealand. And that, as I say, is a sign of our immaturity.
Robin Lane. Having lived through many of these events and even attended Paulo Freire's lecture in Auckland, which opened my eyes in a way I had never anticipated, this last weekend was Martin Luther King's birthday, Memorial Day in the United States. My question is, how far did that religious dimension that arose out of the Southern Leadership Christian Conference influence the Maori radical movement?
I'm not sure it did. I mean, as somebody who's studied the US Black Civil Rights Movement, the role of the church, I think, is fundamental to that movement. But also you might have heard a very good documentary that was played on Radio New Zealand recently about the way in which ministers use the pulpit for political ends, for political messages. I would suggest, as Ranganui has alluded to, that it was a young urban Māori population who took on board the revolutionary aspects of a black civil rights movement without necessarily understanding, being sympathetic to, or taking on board its religious dimensions. So I think they were two quite different issues by the time those messages had come to New Zealand.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I was at that lecture in Auckland when Freire arrived, and there were people in the audience who wanted a recipe, a quick fix to the problem, because Pākehā New Zealanders were upset by this new turn of events, and he refused to give them a recipe. He said, it is up to you, your own nation, to resolve the problem. And he was quite right.
Kia ora tātou, Sunny Amy. I wanted to bring up an event that was, I think, incredibly significant in our history and I think focused on Māori-Pākehā relationships and where we were here, and it hasn't been mentioned as yet, and I would like your opinion about the significance in this area of the 1981 protests on the Springbok tour.
Good question.
I found espousing that cause very difficult in the Māori Council We would meet in the Māori Affairs Committee room in Parliament every quarter of the year, and Auckland, being the Liberal Council, would come with this resolution opposing sporting contacts with South Africa. And the majority of our councils, there are seven or eight, I think, altogether, the majority were rural, and they liked sporting contacts with South Africa, because that's the that's the only time that an international team visited their territory. So it was uphill fight to change the council's mind about that. And even when it was 60-40 in our favour, the president, Sir Graham Latimer, wouldn't move. And eventually we convinced the council, after a 10-year battle, to oppose sporting contacts with South Africa. And at the 81 tour, the invitation came from the East Coast to our president to go to the welcome, to the reception, to the Springboks. And he went in the face of the resolution opposing such an event. But, of course, the East Coast District Council had its own views. But my brother-in-law, Sir Graham, put two bob each way. He said to the Springboks, "I've come here to welcome you, but this will be the last time." Well, when the Māori Council met, all the other councils put in resolutions condemning his action of going to that reception. And one by one they got up and criticised our chairman, and I thought he was a goner for sure. But I hadn't counted on his marvellous oratory and powers of rhetoric. He got up and he said, you know, the chairman has the last word. He said, "When the invitation came from Te Rāwhiti, I agonised whether I should go. I prayed to God for guidance." I thought, it's all over by the shouting. He's got God on his side. So all he got was a slap on the wrist with a wet bus ticket.
I think the 1981 tour was absolutely critical, and it set up what was to follow, both in terms of the hikoi, but also in terms of Pākehā New Zealand, because that was the moment when Pākehā were being challenged. I attended the last planning meeting for the last test in Auckland for the protesters, and it was a very large meeting and a very angry meeting. And the anger came from the Māori protesters and said, "You guys are not taking our leadership on an issue of racism. You should be following us. We should be the leaders. Secondly, you're protesting about racism in another country. Why haven't you ever done that for racism in New Zealand?" And the meeting was about to dissolve, and Tim Shadbolt made a stunning speech about if you're going to attack an institution like the Rugby Union and its supporters, you are entering, if you like, the Holy of Holies of New Zealand. And so can we just keep our differences together for this last event? And it was really saved at the last minute, but it was one of those moments where Pākehā New Zealand was left in no doubt about Māori ambitions, both for this country but also in terms of what Pākehā should do.
We've got time for just one more question, perhaps. Is a lady over there? No? No? Okay. Over here.
I'll make this short and sweet. I'm Josh Clark, kia ora. My question's more to Dr. Paul Spoonley. You talked a little bit about how multicultural can probably support biculturalism. I'm just interested to hear what kind of strategies, as New Zealand does become more, as you know, more multicultural.
Kia ora, Josh. I think Ranganui has a view on this. Can I just give mine and allow Ranganui the right to add his? Immigration has provided New Zealand with a very different set of demographic and political dynamics. As I mentioned in the speech, this country has transformed itself through immigration in a way that very few other countries have post-2000. What I think is very disappointing is that the treaty has not been part of the policy discussions but also that Māori have not been given the role of welcoming those new immigrants here. I think the immigration relationship, if you like, has left Māori out, and that is a position which is unsustainable, and something needs to be done about it. Now, Ranganui might have a view about what should be done.
Kia ora, Paul. The preamble to the treaty is New Zealand's first immigration policy, that the chiefs signing that treaty had agreed to the fact that there were British people coming here to New Zealand, the Queen's people, and they needed to be cared for. But in our own time, immigration has become a tool of economic development, and this is what I personally am opposed to. My strategy is pull up the drawbridge. Now, you think about it. The Polynesians are the people of the sea, tangata o te moana. And their strategy was to go from island to island and eat themselves down the food chain. When they got to New Zealand, they couldn't believe it. There were all these fat seals and big walking chickens called moas, and they ate their way down the food chain. And then suddenly they realised that they'd come up to the limits of growth of the hunting, fishing, gathering economy. So they sent someone off into the Southern Ocean, a guy called Hui Te Rangiora, and he came back and reported, there's no more land. And it's at that point, post-1500, that migration from the Pacific stopped. The ocean-going voyages came to an end. And Māori learned to balance their population with what resources that they had. In our hearings of the Waitangi Tribunal on the Whanganui claim, for instance, the local people there had a special relationship with the long-finned eel, the tuna, that migrate up their rivers. And they rotationally harvest the creeks that feed into that river, and they have never depleted the resource. But under the modern economy, where the state manages the distribution of resources and allocation of fishing quota, that resource is now under stress. And this is the madness of the political economy that doesn't recognise the limits to growth. And so there is a place for tangata whenua in the management of our environment, in the management of our resources, because they have that ancient wisdom and connection to the land that should be harnessed along the operations of our institutions, such as DOC. Ngā kia ora.
That was a good way to end our first session on the Treaty Debate series from Te Papa in Wellington. The speakers, of course, were Professor Paul Spoonley and Emeritus Professor Ranginui Walker, with help from you, the audience, and from Dean Knight of the Law School, and from me, Claudia Orange. So please join us for the next session next Thursday, the 4th of February, to hear Professor Mason Dury and Colin James discussing where the treaty is now in New Zealand, its global impact, and where it is going. Is there a New Zealand agenda? And I'd like you people to show your appreciation for our excellent speakers this evening. Good evening.